May we have appearances, please. Oriental versus Jennings. Good afternoon, and thank you. And thank you to all our guests who are appearing as amicus in response to the court's invitation. A few ground rules first. Justice Fernandez-Vina will be participating. He's going to be listening to the argument in this matter. Just FYI, we had four questions that were presented to everyone to respond to. There's no need to get into the facts, and I say that in particular to those in the front seats on the corners here, because we've already covered that in the prior argument. And We've read the very fine briefs that were submitted. I would encourage concise presentations to the extent that is possible so that we get through all seven as ably as we can. Ms. Harvey.
May it please the court. Good afternoon, Honorable Chief Justice and Honorable Justices. I respectfully request an opportunity for rebuttal.
We may not do that because this is a different kind of presentation, but we'll see.
Thank you, Your Honor. In this case, there's been no question that the $200 verdict was a manifest injustice, and now we're here to decide the remedy. Our dispute with the auditor remedy was that following Cuevas, the trial judge is sitting untethered by anything because it's not tied to a jury verdict, it's outside that verdict, and there's no longer citing to any comparables or the judge's experience. It's only that judge's view of the evidence in the case. We believe that the take-it-or-leave-it auditor is unconstitutional. However, we think that the option that actually came out of the question from Justice Fernandez-Vina, that if both parties were to consent to auditor, that that would save the doctrine and provide the constitutional basis for the remedy. So the purpose in the remedy was to try to save judicial economy and try to put an end to the litigation. The plaintiff, though, if there's an auditor that it is not sufficient, like in this case, that resulted in the no cause, then the plaintiff has been denied the right to a trial by jury. The Constitution says that at least 5/6 of a jury constitutes a verdict. Here, it was one trial judge who was not vetted the same way a jury would have been vetted. And in fact, it's clear that the trial judge, he called himself that he has a reputation for being a remitter judge. So the verdict itself that was added was just unfair. We believe that the plaintiff, at the very least, should be granted a new trial, even if this court does not change the auditor remedy. But we believe that the proposal would, in fact, help both parties. And I think we can't lose sight of the fact that in the instance of an auditor, that plaintiff did meet her burden to prove her case. And that's why the plaintiff should be given the opportunity to consent to that auditor amount. We believe that if the court does adopt the recommendation that both parties consent to the auditor, then it resolves the question that we had originally proposed in our petition, which is, what is the correct standard? And our case law shows that there's never been one set standard for auditor, versus in remitter, there has been set standards. So this court wouldn't have to address that question. But if it did, we believe that the appropriate standard is the highest verdict because it recognizes the fact that the defendant could object, that they could request the new trial, and that it shows that plaintiff did meet the burden. We don't believe that this case is ripe to revise remitter. In fact, we believe from plaintiff's standpoint, she doesn't have standing to really talk about remitter, but it was posed to us as the question. And we feel that in our position, this court shouldn't feel constrained to have to modify the remitter remedy. It was just discussed in 2016 by the same exact court, and we don't believe that it should be addressed again now. However, there is a reason why we think additor should be changed and not remittitor, and those are five reasons. That first, the precedent. The precedent has always been in New Jersey to keep them separate. So in remittitor, the standard has always been the highest verdict that can be sustained by the evidence. And in additor, it's always been what is reasonable. And the cases that have come out, unlike in remittitor that actually uphold the remittitor, certain cases, in additor, the only published decisions, there are six, with the five being it remands for a new trial, only one of which upheld the verdict. And in that case, it was they utilized the highest standard, the highest verdict that could be sustained by the evidence. And next, there's a practical effect that in a remittitor, the defendant has an economic incentive to try to, you're setting the cap, if it's the highest reasonable verdict that could be sustained by the evidence, then you're setting the ceiling for that defendant. And that defendant then might keep trying to retry the case. The plaintiff, though, in an additor, doesn't have that same economic incentive because the plaintiff is the party who wants a judgment, and the defendant is a party who wants to reduce a judgment, try to limit the amount of exposure. And so a plaintiff is less likely to try to get a new trial if the additor is just not enough to the plaintiff, then the defendant is more likely to try to get a new trial to limit the exposure. And we see this happening in our auto arbitration cases in the courtroom, in the courthouse, that they're always de novo'd because the defendant insurance company just wants to take a better shot at trial. So we don't think that factor favors treating additor differently. In addition, there is a public policy issue that in the additor cases, the issue is, was there a compromise verdict? What did the jury get wrong? That doesn't apply in a remittitor. In a remittitor, plaintiff met her burden on all of the factors. There's also a prejudice to the retrial in the remittitor context for a plaintiff because plaintiff did meet their burden. Plaintiff is an injured party, and the retrial could cause a loss of witnesses. Like here, plaintiff's husband, who is a damage witness, is now deceased. So we think that factor favors that not having treating additor differently than remittitor. And lastly, there's a procedural aspect that in a remittitor, the defendant has an additional appellate right. While plaintiff does have it, is to argue that it's against the weight of the evidence, plaintiff isn't likely to argue it because plaintiff won on the verdict. She met her burden and proved all of the elements. So you wouldn't appeal on the basis of against the weight of the evidence, the same way that the defendant has that right to argue the damage award just shows that it was against the weight of the evidence. So we believe that this court can address the additor remedy without necessarily touching the remittitor remedy. Thank you.
So,
if you want consent by both parties and you want to maximize the potential for consent by both parties, wouldn't you be setting a reasonable amount? If it's the highest amount, you're putting the greatest incentive on the defendant to reject it.
Correct, Your Honor. I apologize. I did brief that issue. I believe that if both parties are able to consent in the additor, then the standard could just be any reasonable amount by the court.
What could possibly be the principled justification for the highest amount? If the damages proofs went in and there was an amount that really was too low based upon the proofs in the case, why would a court possibly, as a matter of practice, say, well, we'll take this low verdict and make it the highest possible verdict that we could possibly envision on these proofs? How could that be the standard?
So it's
I know
the
you
highest,
I know you want it, but it's the
highest verdict that's sustainable by the evidence. So that is a factor that goes in. It's just not any amount.
Right, but there could be a huge variation, especially in an emotional distress setting.
And in the Toronto loan case, the discussion as to the different standards is because defendant still has that right to say, that's too high, I want the retrial.
But Toronto loan specific Tron alone, if you look at Tron alone, it was just Judge Cohen was trying to figure out the most rational way to bring the parties together. And he said, your proposal is not the way to do it. That if you're going to have mutual consent, then you reach set an amount, a reasonable amount, that it's more likely that both parties will agree to. Yes?
Yes.
Well, could you...
So,
Can you argue against that?
I think that... Which is why I think the best proposal out there really is that you choose a reasonable amount, but that the plaintiff, because the plaintiff did meet her burden, has the right to say, that's not enough, we should have a retrial.
So you want consent to both, by
correct.
Both?
Yeah.
You know, when you say the plaintiff's met her burden, what? Obviously, we have liability. We're not talking about liability here. Plaintiff has met the elements of the cause of action, whatever it may be, in liability. When you say the plaintiff has met her burden, she has met her burden to the extent the jury said she's met her burden as to damages, right?
Correct.
She's proven the elements of the cause of action, but we're past liability here. As to damages, she's proven something, but she hasn't met a burden that justifies a particular number.
Correct. In this case, it was $200, so Your Honor, it is correct. However, there are circumstances where additor is utilized that is not this case, where it still would result in Justice Solomon had mentioned that this is limited to UIM, but it's really not, because
sorry,
let's give the example of...
If you could slow down a bit.
Sorry.
Limited to what?
It's not just limited to a UIM case.
Right.
That if you have a lien in a case of an ERISA lien, which it has to be... Paid back 100%,
right.
No deduction for an attorney's
fee. Or a comp lien.
Right, and you can't, well, comp lien you sometimes can negotiate, but in an ERISA lien you usually can't negotiate them. So that's boardable. It's given to the jury as an element of damages, and in the event that the award is still less than that lien, then we're in the same situation that we're here within this case. But in that case, you wouldn't argue that plaintiff met her burden on
damages. So when you're saying she met her burden, you're talking about the permanency in this case.
Correct.
But in many cases, there's no particular threshold that has to be met. If the plaintiff is awarded $1,000, they get $1,000.
Correct.
So when you say the plaintiff, it seemed in going through your five factors as to why the two are inherently different, there might be some circumstances in which they are, but we're talking about a general rule here, and there are many cases, would you agree, where remitter and additor really are mirror images of one another. There's no threshold that has to be met by the plaintiff to get any money, for example. It's a matter of what the damages awarded would be. Would you agree with that?
I believe so, but we need to have a rule for additor that would encompass those cases where they are different, right. That those public policy reasons do differ.
Should there be a special rule for additor for UIM cases because of the special burden that is on the plaintiff in that case? I thought originally you were arguing for that.
I believe there should be, but I also have trouble because there are these other circumstances when going back and thinking about it that it would arise in a similar context. It's not a UIM case. So if this court is limited to the UIM context, you'd exclude those cases and it would be the same issue back again that the trial judge is sitting as a resolver of factual issues for the damages. So that's why I think the court has to consider those issues.
But you had a special concern here because there was an award and an additor that didn't get you to the threshold you needed to be to get anything.
Right, and that's because it undermined the purpose of additor. The purpose of additor is to potentially end the litigation. So the trial judge, in determining what remedy to utilize, whether it be a new trial or grant an additor, has to consider, is this going to end the litigation, or am I just starting an appellate process?
The premise of your argument is your constitutional right to a civil jury trial. When a party specifically asks for an additor or specifically asks for a remitter, why could not one argue that because you've made that specific request, you've gone beyond making a motion for a new trial, you are acceding to consenting to a waiver of your right to a jury trial? By requesting it. Go ahead.
I don't believe, because that additor is, it has to, that decision has to be within the trial judge's discretion, so it's subject to the abuse of discretion standard.
But so you make a motion, you can make a motion for a new trial. You don't have to make a motion for an additor. When you specifically ask for an additor, can one argue that by doing so, you're specifically waiving your right to a jury trial and now handing it over to the trial judge?
I believe
by doing so.
If you created a new rule to set forth, then that could be something the court chooses to do. But in terms of this case, I don't think that's the case, especially with the unique posture that at the time the additor was requested, it was based upon He versus Miller, where comparables were given to the judge. And based upon those comparables, the parties came together, and none of the comparables met the amount that the judge actually chose. So in this instance, I believe it's the trial judge abused his discretion. If the court wanted to create a new rule, then that certainly is something that could happen, because the plaintiff then could choose that if they went with the additor, it might avoid having to retry the case.
The problem with the approach, that approach, is that it may discourage additors, and therefore won't permit judges maybe to spontaneously suggest an additor where perhaps both sides should have a right to object if consent. Go ahead.
I think that if that were the rule, because you wouldn't know what number the judge is putting on the case beforehand, then it would discourage an additor, because a plaintiff might not want to take that risk. Especially here, where we had a $200 verdict, the plaintiff probably wouldn't want to take that risk. So then the purpose of additor being a tool of judicial economy attempting to end the litigation would be undermined.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hart.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Gurney, if you could walk us through the four questions and your view on them.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
Walk us through the questions the court had posed.
You want me to go through them?
Please do.
Okay. May it please the court. Thank you. the four questions, which is appropriate for this time of the year, is that first, with regard to should both parties have the right to object to a trial court's editor, or should only the defendant, we submitted on behalf of NJAJ, that yes, both parties should have the right to object, which goes to the constitutional argument made on behalf of the plaintiff in this case. With regard to the next question, should both parties have the right to objection to a trial court's remitter, or should only the plaintiff have that right, and we submit only the plaintiff? I did want to say in that regard that I do not think the court needs to address a remitter in the context of this case, and frankly, I would argue against that.
Of course, we don't have to, but we obviously had a reason for asking these questions.
Sure, you did. You did, because the concept was that it might be the polar opposite of editor, and I submit it's not.
Tell us why we shouldn't address it. Go ahead.
Okay. In remitter, you have a situation where the court has selected portions of the jury verdict. It was already a jury verdict. And the court has selected portions of that verdict to be eliminated based on its review of the proofs in order to save the verdict. And so, of course, the courts talk about lopping off a certain amount of money, but it's in the context where the trial court has made a review of the record, has made a decision that the verdict on balance should be saved, but there is a portion of it that is excessive isn't met by the proofs.
So tell me why that isn't the same process in editor. I know we go through this fiction of a lopping off, but once there's a miscarriage of justice, the court is saying that the amount that was awarded has such pervasive wrongness, it is so excessive, it's got to be thrown out. It's like no part of it is any good. Why, after that's done, isn't the judge engaged in the same sort of fact-finding that you find offensive in editor? And why shouldn't there be consent on both sides?
I think in editor you have the situation contrary to what I was saying on remitter. Editor, the trial court has no idea what proofs were overlooked by the jury. That is, what proofs were found to be inadequate by the jury to award the low verdict that it...
The same is true on the opposite side, Mr. Kern, respectfully. I mean, the jury is not coming back with a verdict and saying, here's our range, we'll go anywhere up to $200,000, we think the proofs show this, but we're going with this. That's not what you get with a verdict, you get a number. So if the number is wrong, the number is wrong as to additor, it means that the jury did not properly apply the instruction to the proofs. That's what the court's finding,
correct,
in essence. If the number is wrong with remittitor, it means that the jury did not properly apply the jury charge to the proofs as to damages. The number is inherently wrong. And I understand good lawyers and great lawyers, and we have great lawyers in this room, can come up with a theory on which a verdict is a range and a verdict is being taken away. But the fact is that both of these devices are ways that courts address numbers that are simply incompatible with the evidence. Why am I wrong about that?
Because I think in a remittitor situation, it's been reviewed, as this court is all too much aware of, in Cuevas, He, Johnson, Fertil, Mickens, other cases, and has been found to be a useful tool whereby the lopping off approach that I suggest, can work and does work.
Right.
In a additor situation, there is, as argued in the Dimmick federal case, based upon the Seventh Amendment, a failure of the jury to reach a verdict that took into consideration all of the proofs that were relevant to the case.
Respectfully, why is that analytically any different from the opposite? I understand you can say it's a failure to apply all the proofs to this point where the number should be over here, but if it's a remittitor, you're saying the jury applied the law to the proofs incorrectly and ended up with a number that is too high. So what you're asking for here is fundamentally an asymmetrical due process. In other words, one party, plaintiffs get to object to both, defendants get to object to only one. To get to that, don't we need to really show we're talking about two very different animals?
Well, I understand the question, and you make a legitimate point. However, in an additor situation, the court does not have the benefit of the jury's verdict at a level from which it can recede or backtrack. Whereas in remittitor,
it's still pivoting off of what Justice Patterson is talking about. If we start out with the right to a civil jury trial, entitles the plaintiff and defendant to a decision by the jury, not just on liability, but on the amount. So if a jury determined liability, you would never say that the judge has a right to determine the damages, particularly unliquidated damages, correct? You'd find that that's a violation of the right to the civil jury trial,
right,
correct? So the question is, why is it once a court has determined that an amount is so pervasively wrong, so grossly excessive as to shock the conscience, why isn't it that the judge now is doing just that, making the inappropriate factual findings when there isn't the consent by both the parties? Why isn't that a violation, in this case, of the defendant's right to a civil jury trial? Go ahead.
If the verdict is so pervasively wrong and constitutes a manifest injustice, what often happens is the entire verdict is thrown out because the court concludes...
That's the only way you can get a remittitor under Cuevas. The verdict has to shock the conscience. It has to be pervaded by a sense of wrongness. The judge can just grant a new trial or, under our current jurisprudence, do a remittitor. But now the question is, how do you determine the remittitor if the judge is going to act as the fact finder? And and there is a waiver of the right to civil jury trial on that issue, should there be consent by both parties, or do we just unloose the trial judge as a fact finder?
I think there should not be consent by both parties in a remittitor situation. I appreciate the potential argument that there that the two methodologies, remittitor and additor, have a similar approach potentially, but the difference is that and that's the argument that's been made before and by plaintiff's counsel as well, which is that in a remittitor situation, you have something to go by. The jury has made a decision of an amount, and the past cases, Cuevas and others, have said the highest verdict is what the highest possible amount is what should be awarded if there's going to be a remittitor. If the entire verdict is so questionable that the damages award bespeaks a question as to whether the entire verdict was questionable, that is, even as to liability, we don't have that in this case, but generally, then a new trial has to be granted. You had asked the question earlier, I believe, is there a waiver if the plaintiff asks for an editor? But what really happens, I believe, in virtually all cases, is the plaintiff or the defense, if it's a remittitor, is asking for a new trial or, in the alternative, a remittitor or an editor. It's not usually one or the other. In other words, you're not normally asking for an editor to the exclusion of a new trial. And there certainly is room for the court, the trial court, to make a decision that the entire verdict is questionable. And that happens, of course. But I do appreciate the fact that there are distinct similarities. The difference, I think, is that in a remittitor situation, the jury has spoken, has given an upside value to the damages in the case, and from that, the court can eliminate those proofs it feels haven't been met relatively easily. Yes, there's a danger that the court might act as a 13th juror, but based on the guideline of Cuevas and other cases, I don't think that would happen. But in a additor situation, the court is left without enough information beyond a low verdict to make a judgment as to what the next highest verdict should be, whether it should be reasonable, the highest. I agree, by the way, it should be reasonable, not the highest verdict.
Mr. Graham, you began by telling us we should stay away from remittitor in this case.
Yes.
What's your view on whether, if there are changes that should be made, whether that can be done through the court rule amendment process? Amend the court rules instead.
I haven't really thought about that. It seems to me that the court rules already permit the motion for a new trial and, as I said, in the alternative for a remittitor or an additor, as the case may be. I don't think the court rules should say or should imply that the choice is to the exclusion of the other. In other words, the waiver concept that was raised. I don't think that's necessary. And the interesting thing about additor is it has not come.
I'm speaking more generically, if you will, rather than tackling in this opinion where you'd begun by saying don't go there, decide your additor case. Can changes to the extent they are appropriate be made through the court rule process instead?
Potentially. I'd have to have the language right in front of me, and I don't.
Wouldn't we first have to determine whether or not this is substantive law or procedural law? Like, we wouldn't be doing a court rule if we were touching on a matter of substantive law, correct?
I agree.
Well, if we decided that perhaps these devices are outmoded and need to be rethought along the lines of some of the suggestions we're getting through the answers to the questions that we asked, then perhaps the court rule would allow for a wider audience to comment on that process, would it not?
Potentially, yes.
Because we have suggestions that convert it to an entire settlement process instead of this consent by one or two of the parties and what standard applies. I mean, these are major changes to procedures that have a lot of trouble associated with them,
I agree.
At least from the amount of appellate work they're generating.
But by and large, I think the court would agree that the process seems to have worked pretty well over the years. I mean, there are very few remitter cases even, and there are a complete dearth of cases in the additor situation.
So how helpful are these processes?
Well, I don't know. It seems to me that we've been given a lot of guidance by the Cuevas decision, and the idea that the court is supposed to do exactly what the jury is asked to do under the model jury charge, which is a rather amorphous standard, to mm-hmm. say the least. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, if we ask the juries to do that, then we certainly can ask the court to do it, or the courts to do it. And for the most part, I believe it has been successful.
So, speaking on behalf of NJAJ and the lawyers, many lawyers whom you represent or your organization represents, is additor something that lawyers would like to have, simply to wrap up a case and not have to get the damages expert back? You know, particularly maybe a smaller case where additional money would be appropriate and needed, but bringing back for 4 or 5 days of damages proofs is going to end up being not cost effective for the lawyers.
Well, that is a big factor. I mean, from a plaintiff's perspective, the cost of trying a case has become outrageous, and to the extent that there a mechanism exists, additor or remitter for that matter, that enables the verdict to be the trial to be saved, the verdict mm-hmm. to be saved, subject to modifications, that certainly is something the bar would want. Yes.
So you're not arguing against then the concept of a bilateral consent and a waiver of a new trial. So bilateral consent to negotiate after, and but you have to waive the new trial.
I don't think a waiver of the new trial is required to effect the purpose of additor. In other words, if the court concludes that there was a failure on the part of the jury to reach, to take into consideration properly the proofs on damages, it can make that determination, and if either side decides that's unacceptable in an additor situation, they could ask for a new trial. The difference is that currently, with the additor process, the remedy is nothing for the plaintiff is only an appeal, and that seems onerous for no good reason. So I don't think you need a waiver of the possibility of a new trial. In fact, I would submit that to create a situation where you have a waiver will only take away the leverage that either side has in the situation, whether it's remitter or additor.
But how do you get the winning party, for lack of a better term, to the table if you don't have the losing party waive?
Well, each side is going to have the same problem with respect to a new trial. That is, as we learned, witnesses may become unavailable, the cost of witnesses, and that's a problem for both sides. Usually the defense has the better of that just financially, but not always. And I think if you still retain the right to assert that a new trial is the only remedy that will resolve the dispute because the amounts that are being awarded or remitted are inadequate, it still serves its purpose and still serves the purpose to allow the parties to be put in a position of recognizing they will have to potentially negotiate, reach a conclusion without the benefit of an actual new trial.
Thank you, Mr. Green.
Sure.
Mr. Regenia.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Questions have been posed by this court as to which parties may object to additor or remittitor and as to what quantum of damages should be set when they are employed. The answers are simple and readily apparent. Decades of sound jurisprudence make clear that only the defendant has the right to object regarding additor, while only the plaintiff has that right as to remittitor. As to damages, the lowest amount reasonably supported by the record is to be set as to additor, while the highest amount reasonably supported by the record is utilized for remittitor. Despite protestations otherwise, there are no constitutional infirmities as to these concepts. Indeed, 62 years ago in Fitch, this court concluded that the practices of remittitor and additor violate none of our constitutional interdictions and, if fairly invoked, serve the laudable purpose of avoiding a further trial where substantial justice may be attained on the basis of the original trial. Those concepts have been fairly invoked in the past and must continue to be fairly evoked into the future. The right to object can only rest with one party. What plaintiff, already dissatisfied with the jury's verdict, would not object to additor in the hopes of obtaining a more favorable result in a new trial? Conversely, what defendant would not do the same regarding remittitor? Allowing both parties the right to object would have the practical effect of eliminating additor and remittitor almost entirely, resulting in the unintended consequence of significantly increasing new trials, the very outcome that has been sought to be avoided. With regard to damages, it is clear that a minimalist approach is best. Courts should modify the award in the least intrusive manner possible, which has been accepted as the most analytically sound approach. Time and again, the method utilized for remittitor has been to reduce an excessive jury verdict to the highest reasonable award supported by the record, as evidenced in Fratilli, Jastrom, and He. Indeed, not even 3 years ago, this court in Cuevas again recognized that the highest reasonable award is to be utilized. Conversely, the lowest reasonable award would then logically be used for its counterpart, additor. Again, these principles must be invoked fairly as to all parties. However, arguments have been advanced that would seek to bestow enhanced rights to one party to the disadvantage of the other. Specifically, the appellant would seek to allow all plaintiffs the right to object as to both remittitor and additor, while not bestowing an opportunity upon defendants. Plaintiff would also seek to impose the highest possible award for both remittitor and additor, again at the disadvantage of the defendants. The only amicus to suggest disproportional application was the New Jersey Association of Justice, which would allow only a plaintiff the ability to object to both, and would set an additor award at a middle ground approach, while remittitor would remain at the highest reasonable award. Those arguments cannot be accepted, as there must be uniformity and equality in the application of these judicial constructs. One party should not have an unjust advantage to the detriment of the other. As previously noted, these are equally at opposite remedies that require equally at opposite applications. The courts have regarded them as such for years, and no compelling reasons have been offered to change these decades-long precedent. As such, it is respectfully submitted that this court continue the practice of allowing only plaintiff to object to remittitor, only defendant to object to additor, that the highest reasonable award be utilized for remittitor, and the lowest reasonable award be utilized for additor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Bloom.
Thank you. Your Honors, excuse me. Obviously, there's been a number of briefs that have been filed and pages have been read. One acknowledgement that I have not seen in any of the papers, and I think it sort of breathes life into the analysis here, is that there seems to be an unspoken assumption that a grossly excessive verdict has no meaning. And I take issue with that, because there is a basis by which a jury gets to the end when they are then asked to assess the value. In other words, and I It's actually, this was a record for keeping this on my lapel. I think about an hour and 20 minutes. Apologize. Your Honor questioned counsel who repeatedly stated, we proved our claim. And your counsel made the point, well, maybe you proved liability and maybe you proved some element of damage such that there was an award of $200. But the reality is, particularly in the personal injury context, every case beyond the issue of liability has the issue of damages, which entails causation, and then certainly the explanation of the residuals of the damages of the injuries, I should say. When we look at a jury verdict of $200, or conversely, when we look at a grossly excessive verdict, we can reasonably presume, and I would say should reasonably presume, in the recognized interest of the presumption of correctness of a jury verdict, that there is meaning there to be discerned. And what is that meaning? Well, in a quote-unquote unduly low verdict, it is readily presumed and reasonably presumed that the jury concluded that the plaintiff did not meet his or her burden as to certain elements of damages. Again, my experience is in the personal injury context, so you know, if plaintiff alleges injuries to body parts X, Y, and Z, you discern from the jury's verdict that they didn't accept X and Y as causally related. But conversely, we look at what we called a grossly excessive verdict, and whereas we want to, in essence, throw out the verdict, we can still take meaning from the verdict, and that meaning, of course, is that the jury, reasonably it is presumed, accepted the plaintiff's proofs. The plaintiff proved to them that I sustained injury X, Y, and Z in this accident. Now, we may take issue, and we have taken issue, obviously, in the context of this discussion, with the value that is placed on their findings of a causal relationship. But I don't think we can say that the verdict itself is meaningless and there's nothing to be discerned from it.
I'm trying to follow you.
Sure.
Every jury verdict has a presumption of correctness, liability, and damages. In the case of damages, once the court finds that there was a miscarriage of justice because it was either grossly excessive or grossly low, that presumption of correctness is gone. Puff, it's gone. Correct?
Correct.
Okay, so what is left to be discerned once that's been exploded?
Well, because, Your Honor, I am distinguishing between the excessive verdict and the underlying basis on which the jury placed this excessive number. In other words, and I'm just going to be repeating myself, but in other words, if we have a grossly excessive verdict, I think we can reasonably discern that the jury found the plaintiff established their burden of proof to establish the injuries, to establish their claims.
That's liability. We're done with that.
No. I'm talking about damages.
Go ahead.
If I come to a jury and my claim is that I injured my shoulder in this accident and the defense is, well, no, you didn't, because you injured it, you know, 2 years earlier and you didn't have any complaints for 5 months after, if the jury verdict comes back excessively high, we can reasonably presume that the jury found that the injury alleged was connected to the accident. Conversely, if the verdict comes back unduly low, we can reasonably presume that the jury found that the claimed injury was not related to the accident.
So are you arguing against continuing additor and remittitor?
I am not. I'm not arguing against that. What I take from that is a couple of things. Number one is there is meaning to be given to an excessive or unduly low verdict. In other words, I'm not suggesting that we throw it out of hand. Okay? So then where do we go from there? And so number one is, again, in the interest of the presumption of correctness of the verdict and wanting, and also it also assists us towards the goal of judicial economy, we're trying to save the verdict, if you will. So that's where additor and remittitor come in. The second point then is, okay, we talk about the range. Do we do it the high end, the low end, the middle? And I would suggest that in order to accord meaning that I think is reasonably taken from such a verdict, in order to accord meaning to it, then again, if you have a low verdict in which additor is appropriate, I think you're breathing life into the verdict, into the jury's determination, that is, that the plaintiff did not prove or largely did not prove their claim. So you would add it so that you're up to the lowest reasonable number. Again, you're giving meaning to the jury verdict. Whether or not the jury placed the correct number on their findings, nonetheless, their findings are reasonably presumed.
I'm trying to understand this. Why would the court import meaning to a verdict that has been decided to be so pervaded by a sense of wrongness? It's so grossly excessive, okay, that it shocks the judicial conscience. Like, what meaning am I supposed to draw from that? Because that is the standard for either granting a new trial or granting an additor or remittitor. There's no presumption to correctness to that, something that shocks the conscience.
Well, in the present context of remittitor and additor, we are according it significance, right? Am I correct on that? I mean,
I see that you are.
Well, also the case law has. 200 years of precedent has.
Well,
you're arguing for the status quo.
Yeah.
I am arguing for the status quo, yes.
And you're arguing that this has worked well, that it honors the verdicts to some degree, the judge is minimally intrusive, and you're arguing for one party consent on each side.
To the extent the considerations have always been the right to a jury trial judicial economy.
Is there consent on one side? Go back to Fish. I think you mentioned Fish, right?
I don't believe
again,
I did.
Again, someone else did.
Yes.
So in Fish, the judge, in the additor context, it was the judge who imported the additor. Plaintiff didn't ask for the additor. The judge put the additor. And then what? Is the defendant supposed to have the right to accept it or deny it? That seems to be like a gross disadvantage to a plaintiff who hasn't requested the additor. Wouldn't you agree?
I would agree in that. I think there is a distinction. I believe that if a plaintiff has asked simply for a new trial, or a party has asked for a new trial, has not sought the additor, I think that is a distinction. However, that being said, I still come back to, and I know I have not convinced you and will not convince you, but I still come back to the same notion that there is meaning to be given to the jury's decision making, not the excessive number or unduly low number. So thereby, you know, the plaintiff, we go ahead, we try a case. Okay, I'm the defendant, I'm the plaintiff, whatever it may be. And let's say I'm the plaintiff. So I put my proofs on. I'm trying to causally relate X, Y, and Z injuries, okay? And the jury comes back with a very low number, okay? In my mind, again, going back to my premise that there is meaning to be taken from these verdicts, or at least, again, from the steps being taken, in my mind, I have had my jury trial, and the jury has rejected my claims of X, Y, and Z being attached to this automobile case. So therefore, I don't believe then it is wrong to say I don't have a right to object to the additor. At that point, you're fortunate to have the additor. You had your trial. The jury did not believe your client, or the jury did not believe your doctor. The jury did not accept your damages. You had your trial. And I don't think you should then get a second bite at the apple.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Thompson.
Good afternoon. My name is David Codd. I'm a lawyer with McCarter and English, and I represent the Amicus Curiae, the New Jersey Business and Industry Association, which is the largest business association in New Jersey. Its members employ over 1 million New Jersey residents. The plaintiff is a 34-year-old investment banker from New York. He's a partner at Goldman. He's at one of the large casino hotels in Atlantic City and has a diving accident at the pool. He becomes a quadriplegic. His lost wage claim is $14 million. His life care claim is $8 million. He has catastrophic pain and suffering. The jury finds the defendant 100% liable and awards $500,000. And the reason they do that is because he's an African American. Or the reason they do that is the jury consciously decided to ignore and not follow the judge's instruction on damages. Or the reason they did that is because when they deliberated, they went on the internet and found an article that said in 5 months there'll be a cure for quadriplegia. Infertile, this court said, the reason why remittitor should be the highest amount is we want to tamper is the word, tamper the least with the verdict. I would hope that everybody in this courtroom, the justices and the lawyers, could agree in my example, that's a verdict we want to tamper with the most. We don't want to give 1 ounce of deference to that verdict. Let me put it in legal terms. Rule 4:49. That verdict clearly and convincingly is a manifest injustice. Baxter, that verdict shocks the judicial conscience. Cuevas, that verdict is plainly wrong. So we believe the court should change the current law, and both for remittitor and for additor, make the standard not the highest for remittitor, not the lowest for additor, but rather a reasonable amount that a jury would award based on the trial record. And there is a tremendous practical advantage to that. If the trial judge, after sitting through an entire trial, puts a number on it that's the reasonable number, and the plaintiff's lawyer has to go to her client and say, this independent judge thinks this is a reasonable number, and the defendant has to go to his client and say this independent judge thinks this is a reasonable number, the chances of that case settling at or near that number is very high. And this court has a couple decisions that settlement is to be encouraged and advances the public policy of this state. Finally, on the issue of should both parties be allowed to consent, if you keep the standards the same, highest for remittitor, lowest for additor. And now you add to that that both parties must consent. As a practical matter, you've done away with additor and remittitor. And the reason I say that, let's deal with additor as an example. If you keep the standard at additor, the lowest amount, and that now the plaintiff's lawyer can object to that and get a new trial, she's going to object every time. Indeed, I think it would be legal malpractice per se for a plaintiff's lawyer to accept an additor at the lowest amount a reasonable jury could award when she has the option of saying, no, I want a retrial. So for that reason, we believe on who has a right to consent, the law ought to remain the same. In remittitor, only the plaintiff, and in additor, only the defendant.
Mr. Cott, wonder if you can help me with something.
I'm glad to try, Your Honor.
We logically went beyond additor toward the presentation that we have today based on the issues that both editor and remittitor present so that we could explore what to do in this case and what to do with the larger question. And we're trying, as you aptly just put, to find the right spot, to be practical, to foster resolution of these cases. So we brought in able parties and amici to come and speak to us, and they start representing their members at different spots. My concern is, in doing so, we may have left out an important group of objective, likewise gifted people who try to settle cases every day. I'm thinking of our civil PJs up and down the state, whose daily efforts we might gain some insight from as well. Is there a sensible way for us to engage other voices as we try to find the right spot, much of which relates to our rulemaking capacity?
Yeah, and I'm going to go over to my friend, Mr. Gern. That one I had not really thought of as he had not thought of. It seems to me, and I don't know the answer, Justice Albin, whether this is substantive law or rulemaking. I do not know the answer to that. I'd have to look at. But it seems to me that in this court's jurisprudence, you've always treated it as substantive law. You have a lot of cases, particularly with remittitor. The appellate division has something like 5 or 6 with additor. So it seems to me that this court has always treated that as substantive law.
So let me stay with that for a second. Were we to say the highest, the lowest, or the most reasonable amount, right, with an eye toward resolution and efficiency is a question of substantive law and not necessarily one of how to foster settlement of cases?
Well, the answer is I think it is substantive. The result might be that it has an impact on settlement.
Isn't it substantive for two reasons? Number one, we're dealing with the right to a civil jury trial. And the question is, what is the appropriate function of a judge and a jury within this sphere? Then we're also talking about alterations of the common law, which has governed this area of the law for more than 200 years, probably 200 years, at least 200 years. I don't know of any state that has ever decided this issue based upon its court rules. Are you?
No, I'm not aware of any. And that's what I was saying. This court has treated it as common law. You've got a lot of cases that deal with remittitor, shock the conscience, 449. You've got a lot of cases that deal with that.
Please finish. Go ahead. Your proposal sounds like, and state bar is quite similar to yours, sounds like a settlement effort after the trial has been resolved.
Well, no, it's more fundamental than that, because my problem with the highest and lowest, coming back to the Atlantic City case that I talked about, is in some ways, on the highest, it's because we want to give credit to what the jury did. But the jury did something that shocked the conscience. It may be a lot more than they simply got it wrong. It might be that they, and that's why I used the hypo I did, they had an ill motive.
So your reasonable amount, the one that you argued, which is the one that is most likely to bring both parties together, would be the most efficacious and probably logical approach, particularly if you permitted both sides the right to consent or object, correct?
I'm not sure. If you do the reasonable amount, the issue of whether both parties should be allowed to consent is a much less important issue. You still may have to call it and decide it, but nobody's getting hurt too badly once this court tells the trial judge, instead of highest and lowest, you're going to do the reasonable amount.
But isn't that essentially the most, if the goal is settlement, that settles the case? I mean, if there's a reasonable amount thrown out there and there's no objection, or there's no objection by either party, they've just settled the case.
Correct.
So does that work effectively to resolve cases?
Well, I think it would, for the reason I said. I would report to my client, as would every lawyer, that Judge Smith or Judge Jones in Middlesex or Camden County tried the case, heard the entire record, we had a post-trial motion, and she said a reasonable number is X. That's got to have a big impact on both plaintiffs and defendants.
Even if it didn't settle it, it would probably put it on the road to settlement. It might not be that number, but the parties would be circling around that number.
Let me ask you, if you would, to respond. Mr. Gern made an argument for plaintiff having the right to object on both, and as to why analytically he sees the two as different. Would you respond to that?
Sure. And there's four responses. The main response is what I came back to before. You only get to the result that Mr. Gern argued for if you're going to give some homage to the verdict in the high verdict situation. That is, you don't want to tamper with that verdict. But that verdict, I'll switch the hypothetical, Mrs. Smith on the escalator at one of the casino hotels sprains her ankle, and the jury awards $50 million. And the reason they did it is the jurors think gambling's immoral. Or they did it because during deliberations they went on the internet and saw the revenues of the casino. So I throw out entirely giving any deference to that jury verdict, but Justice Patterson, there are two or three other reasons. Number one, you've already disturbed the verdict. As soon as you've granted the remitted or editor, indeed, you might take the verdict away entirely.
Let me be more specific in my question. Mr. Gern viewed, and I'm speaking for him, he can articulate it, I'm sure, better than I can, but he viewed editor as analytically different from remitter because plaintiff has met her burden.
Oh, I see.
See, and therefore, plaintiff should have the ability to object to the editor, object to the remitter. Defendant only gets to object to the editor.
Not my response, and I don't mean this flippant, she hasn't met her burden much. $200 verdict, this case is the example. Jury clearly discarded her testimony.
Do you see these two as mirror images of one another?
I do. And I would say this. This court, and I'm being factual, I'm not being judgmental, this court has typically often had very pro-plaintiff, pro-consumer holdings. Henningsen, Bishada, Adelies. What this court has never done is on these procedural devices treated plaintiffs and defendants differently. This court has been completely neutral. The scales of justice have been like this. Same number of jury challenges, same day number of days to file a motion for a new trial, all throughout the rules, all throughout the procedural common law. Part of the reason this court has credibility, despite some somewhat liberal decisions, is that it is a fair court, and it's perceived, particularly by my client, which is the business community, as a fair court. As soon as you adopt the arguments made by the plaintiffs, you're doing what some other states do, which is now the rules are tilted and the scales are not evenly balanced. So I know in the first argument, which I watched, defendant's counsel talked about fairness. It is fairness, but it's fairness that's more important than good old-fashioned high school fairness. It's for the credibility of the court.
Anything you'd like to add?
We thank the court again for allowing us to appear as an amicus.
Thank you. Ms. Keller.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Emily Keller. I'm from Greenbaum, Rowe, Smith & Davis, and I'm here appearing on behalf of the Trial Attorneys of New Jersey. I would first like to take this opportunity to thank the court for allowing Trial Attorneys of New Jersey to weigh in on this issue, on this very important issue. We took it very seriously, and we had hours of deliberation among our board members and our officers because we think it is such an important issue. TANJ is an organization comprised of plaintiffs and defendants bar attorneys, as well as retired judges. And we have attorneys who practice in medical malpractice, in business disputes, in consumer rights, in products liability. So as you can imagine, we don't agree on everything. We don't agree on a lot. But we do agree, and there's one unifying principle at TANJ, and that is the importance of the jury trial. And we believe that central to that is the role of the jury in awarding damages. As recognized by this court on countless occasions, the ability to award damages is an essential element of the role of the jury. Many cases today are resolved by settlement, and as a result, I think that perhaps people might think that the role of the jury trial is not as essential or important as it once was. But at TANJ, certainly the members of TANJ believe that the jury is as important, if not more important, because the underpinning of our judicial system is still based on the jury trial, and all of these settlements that people, all of these alternative dispute resolution mechanisms and settlements that people reach are reached on the basis of the jury trial. I'm sure that many of the lawyers, even in this courtroom, were trained the way that I was trained, thinking that the way to attain a good settlement is to be ready to submit your case to a jury. So the right to have disputes resolved by a jury of one's peers is the foundation upon which our system rests, and the quantum of damages, and the jury being the sole arbiter of that quantum of damages, is of critical importance. And it's for that reason that TANJ believes that on those rare occasions when a verdict is so clearly wrong that it shocks the judicial conscience, the appropriate remedy is the award of a new trial. While TANJ recognizes that this is an added burden on judicial resources, TANJ's belief is that these are resources well spent. In the event that the court declines to eliminate additor and remittitor, TANJ believes that the appropriate standard to be applied when establishing additor and remittitor is in cases, instances of remittitor is the highest amount, and in instances of additor would be the lowest amount. And the belief for that is that that's truest to the original verdict and gives the jury the most say and protects the integrity of the jury verdict to the greatest extent. However, we believe it's critical that both the plaintiff and the defendant have the right to accept the additor or remittitor. I know that people today have said that that would be the same thing as eliminating additor and remittitor. I don't think that's true. The members of TANJ don't think that's true. I think that if there's one thing that is evidenced, even by the attorneys standing up here and arguing today, and certainly by all of us when we were in practice, is that people are not nearly as eager to retry cases, not lawyers and not litigants, as you might lead your adversary to believe at the bargaining table. So I think that if you have additor and remittitor, that still is a mechanism that could easily lead to settlement if you leave that intact. But I think that the idea that you only have one party accepted creates an unfair disadvantage. And I think that's apparent from what happened in this case, where you have a plaintiff who won on liability, had a court recognize that the verdict was a manifest injustice, and is still here in this court arguing to try and get a new trial because there wasn't a just award of damages during this process.
Well, once you take the position that both sides can object or consent, doesn't it make sense then to go to the figure that is most likely to bring the two parties together, and that is a reasonable amount, rather than figures at the polls, which is more likely to lead one party to reject it?
I think that that sounds like it would be more likely to lead to settlement. I'm not sure and I think that the members of TANJ had a real problem understanding how a judge was going to come up with that reasonable number in absence of the jury, which is why we ended up, and as I said, we spent a lot of time thinking about it and how we ended up with, we thought the most appropriate remedy is a new trial under those circumstances, because it is an odd circumstance. It doesn't happen all the time. It's a rare circumstance when a verdict constitutes a manifest injustice. But I think that it would be extremely difficult to determine what that reasonable amount is, and I don't know how you can distinguish between just the mere now you're just substituting the judge's reasoning for that of the juror.
It's no more difficult than setting the highest or the lowest, and if both sides get to object, then it's really a settlement figure. That's what it amounts to, yes?
Well, I agree that it really is a settlement figure, which is why I think it's critical, and the members of TANS thought it was critical that both parties have the right to object, is because it is a settlement figure, and the thought was that the real outlier figures, it's the lowest amount that a reasonable jury would award. So in the case of the person who has been rendered a paraplegic, I am assuming that when the judge comes up with that number, he's going to have to take into effect care for the rest of his life. I don't think that number is going to be so, I'm not sure that it will be so different between what is the lowest amount and what is a reasonable amount in those circumstances, because I think that when they try to substitute themselves for the place of the jury and come up with a number, at that point, I would assume that that's going to be a pretty substantial number for a 34-year-old man who has been rendered a paraplegic. But I think that was the real concern at TANJ, is I'm not sure how you substitute the judge's reasonable figure for the one that was arrived at by the jury. I think that one of the things that was very meaningful to members of TANJ is a quote from the dissent in He, where it talks about, "The constitutional right is a profound faith in the ability of ordinary men and women of varying experiences and backgrounds who serve as jurors to render a fair verdict, and if the plaintiff prevails, to award reasonable damages." And I think that you do tremendous disservice to that when you try to come up with one judge's opinion of what a reasonable verdict would be.
The reality of the situation is that you don't need to find the magic number for settlement. The judge doesn't have to find that number. The judge has to find, in order to settle the case, the judge has to find a number that is within the range, that taking into account trial costs and risks as to how it could go the second time is close enough to start the process going in terms of talking. So you're going to have a number of different figures that would actually trigger a settlement process.
And I agree that that is true, and I believe that that was part of the thought, is that experienced counsel at this point is not nearly as eager to retry case after case, and litigants are not either. Mm-hmm. I mean, trying a case takes a big toll on litigants, and unless you're, I guess, somebody who's in court all the time, I don't think that, I don't agree it would be plaintiff's malpractice to allow your client to accept the lowest possible verdict that was provided by a court, because I also think that an experienced jurist, when they decide what the lowest possible verdict is, it's going to be a lot closer to the reasonable, I think, to the reasonable verdict than is being portrayed necessarily, and particularly if they know that both parties have the right to reject it. But I do think that the right to reject it on behalf of both parties is essential, because otherwise I think that you are putting one person in an untenable situation, and that would not be true to our constitutional right to a jury trial.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Menzel.
May it please the Court, Chief Justice Ravner and fellow justices, I'm here on behalf of the New Jersey State Bar Association. And if I may, get right to the questions. The answer to the first two on behalf of the State Bar are that we think that both parties should have the right to object in either case. And then the later two questions, the question of, well, what is the number that a judge would put on? The State Bar thinks that it should just be a reasonable number for the case. What I have to say here today is not so different from what you just heard from Tange. But if I may, the idea here is that we have a miscarriage of justice. That's what got us to this point. There is a finding that the jury verdict that was delivered, it shocks the judicial conscience. In the State Bar's mind, these are no longer, this number that came out is no longer a marker, because it doesn't have any credibility. It's that far beyond. It's not a high or a low verdict, or a very high or a very low verdict. It's a verdict that is beyond that. So at that point in time, we have a real problem with that verdict, and both parties do. And it's the State Bar's position that the aggrieved party, in remitter, for example, you get an extremely high verdict. The defendant is an aggrieved party. That party is not given, under the current state of the law, the right to object and seek a new trial. They are going to rely on plaintiff to hopefully do so. And that is something that, by giving both parties the option to object and seek a new trial, that's corrected at that point. Because both parties, you can see that there is potential prejudice at the very least to both parties in a situation where there is a miscarriage of justice and a verdict that shocks the judicial conscience. So it's the State Bar's position that once you have that number, you need to allow both parties to look at this and decide what they want to do before they lose their chance at a fair jury trial on damages. If you look at other circumstances with trials where parties do waive certain rights, whether it's with molding verdicts with liens, molding verdicts with UM or UIM, high and low agreements between parties, expedited trials, in all these circumstances, there is already a legal basis for it, or there's an agreement between the parties that you're going to move or tamper with or change a verdict, or that you're going to let the judge do so. In this case, under the current state of the law, you don't have that. And you have to keep looking back at that, where it starts with the miscarriage of justice, because that affects both parties. And as the State Bar submitted in its papers, it certainly affects the aggrieved party on either side of the case, whether it's an additor or a remitter circumstance. The aggrieved party is not getting the right currently necessarily to seek a new trial, and the State Bar takes issue with that. So the first two questions, we say that both parties should have the right to object and seek a new trial. As to the number that a judge would put on in an additor or a remitter circumstance, we believe that in either instance, it should be a reasonable number supported by the record. The idea of having highest and lowest numbers, I think, and the fact that we're all here today, it's shown through history that that's problematic. I think it also, when you try to figure out what the highest or lowest number is, you're essentially finding a range, a realm of reason. So you are looking toward that reasonable number and then deciding on which side of it you would fall. Parties have had problems with that, and in fact, when it's a highest and lowest number, they tend to object anyway. In the current circumstance, where both parties would have the right to object, having a highest or lowest number almost essentially leads you to a new trial. The idea under this proposal from the State Bar would be that in giving a reasonable number, you at least have a chance at pushing towards settlement, at trying to resolve the case. And the judge is able to do so without the risk of the constitutional issue. You know, you don't have this weight on your shoulders anymore because either party can still get a trial. And so that's a lot of weight off that judge's shoulders who's trying to figure out the best way to move this case forward, get satisfaction for the parties, and hopefully get the case settled. But again, you know, we propose that the judge should look at the record, just as Cuevas had suggested, when they pick a number. But in this circumstance with the bar's, state bar's proposal, the method that the judge chooses to try to find a number, it's not so important anymore. What's important is the judge looking at the circumstances that are before him or her and trying to decide the best way to move this case towards that reasonable number, or as Your Honor suggested before, yeah, look at what is happening here and see if we can't get this case towards a settlement. If you can't, then you have a retrial. That constitutional right is still there. But this gives the court and the parties a new opportunity to try to resolve this case. You know, we look at the non-binding mandatory arbitration before, and now come post-trial to this. You've just watched a whole trial. You've seen how your witnesses have performed. You've seen different evidentiary rulings on damages-related issues. So you have some new knowledge that you didn't have before. Mm-hmm. So it's a renewed opportunity to look at the case. And I agree with counsel before. Most litigants don't want to be out there doing this again. Most parties have waited 3, 4, sometimes more years to get to their trial. And they're at a point where now they've seen how it plays out. They've seen that there's risk. And in fact, they just got a jury verdict that, you know, was on the polar end, either too great or too small. So that's palpable. So this is a great opportunity to revisit the attempt to settle it. And the judge isn't going to have that same burden that he or she would have under the current system when they try to pick a number to put on the case. And I also... excuse me, think that there may be some circumstances where the judge grants a new trial and doesn't feel that putting a number, remitting or adding to the verdict is the right thing. And that could be so. But both parties have the right in the event that they want a new trial, they've sought one, that they can get that trial in that instance. Looking overall at how this would affect the system, I think it's fair to say that there may be less findings that verdicts shock the judicial conscience. And I think that's what we want, because in general, we're trying to protect verdicts from juries. So we don't want them touched unless they absolutely need to be. Any judge that finds a verdict shocks the conscience knows that both parties now will have the right to a new trial. So if a verdict is somewhere within the realm of reason, then the judge is not going to want to touch that. Let's let that verdict stand. Parties can still appeal and file an appeal, but now they'll file an appeal, or at least if the judge does a remitter or additor, there won't be a number problem anymore, which is a big deal, because when a judge is forced to pick a number, and we saw this going from he to Cuevas, there are many considerations that the judge goes through. And there are a lot of pitfalls, and the law has obviously changed as to what may or may not be considered. We're not going to have that issue anymore to the extent there are appeals. Any questions, Your Honor?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Harper, we're not here in the traditional way that we usually are with the appellant. Is there something that you wanted to raise that has not been touched on before?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you.